Are you telling me that legacy media does not understand yes. the modern context of delivering content to consumers? I am Sit just down. Absolutely shocked. Yes.
Welcome to Lawyers Behaving Badly. I am Jennifer Judge.
And I'm Karen Delaney. And I started laughing as soon as I saw you tonight because... Where are you?
You're looking live at me podcasting from my car again tonight. A throwback.
This is actually a milestone for us. This is episode number 40.
Oh, and, perfect.
And we're taking it back to our roots by having you podcast in your car.
Yeah, the construction continues. It is currently, we just hit record at 8:05 p.m. and we have used this contractor for many things in our house. Like, we're basically going room by room renovating it, and we absolutely love him. And one reason is because he gets done very quickly, but part of the reason he's able to get done so quickly is because his guys stay till like 8:30 at night, which is wonderful in the long term, but it's kind of late to have these guys coming in your house, in and out of your house at 8:30 at night.
It's really putting a crimp in our podcasting plans. And on top of that, we have to hope that the electrical grid holds out because we're under yes. yet another conservation notice because Texas sucks shit as usual. And our power might go out because there's more demand than there is supply. So that's fantastic.
We're really rolling the dice with this episode, folks.
Doing it the way we did back in the early days.
Exactly. So how are you doing, friend?
Well, I don't have anything specific to report. I'm going to be necessarily sort of vague about this, but I've been reflecting this week on the fact that I have accomplished a goal that I set out for myself when I really committed to this solo practice. And I'm just sort of amazed and I'm constantly astonished that this is actually a going profitable concern. And I feel very lucky and privileged to be where I am in my career right now. And I honestly just never thought I would be here. Like, you know, I've had some dark times.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah. And there have definitely been times where I'm like, I don't know how anybody does this long term. I have no idea how anybody can possibly, like, at 10 years of practice, look down the road and be like, I got to do this for another fucking 30 years. Are you kidding?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like this is maybe the first time that I've felt like I could really do this long term. You know, I could really, like, and I liked being an in-house lawyer. I liked it too, but this just feels really different and I'm really grateful for my practice. And so I've just kind of been reflecting on that. And like I said, I'm being necessarily vague about it, but I've been reflecting on that this week, especially.
That's awesome. And I can't tell you, one, how proud of you I am because I know how much work you're doing. I know. And two, how thankful I am that you did this because as I've publicly called you many times, you were my solo Sherpa. And yeah. So I would not have been able to do this but for you when I was a solo as well. So one, for very selfish reasons, thank you. And also, it's very nice to see your friends, you know, kick ass when you know that they're awesome. So
and I am definitively mm-hmm. awesome. So I appreciate that. I appreciate it. I appreciate the kind words and it's just nice. And so that's kind of what's been on my mind lately.
Well, I got COVID over the weekend and it fucking sucks, y'all. My last go around with COVID was sometime in fall 2022 and it wasn't that bad. Like, I was only sick for 2 days and it really wasn't terrible, but this one's kicked my ass. It's really bad this time, at least for me. So I'm hoping nobody else in my family gets it, but I'm on the struggle bus. And today's the first day I haven't had a nap since Thursday. So that's like big improvement for me, but it also means I'm going to bed like literally the minute we finish recording this episode. Yeah.
And to be clear, I did tell you we didn't have to do the podcast. Yes. This is your choice.
No, this was my choice. No, that's not true. Karen was texting me and was like, you will do this podcast episode.
I know. If you're a real friend.
Exactly.
No, I feel like I'm definitely getting 20, 21 vibes again, where I feel like everybody is getting it again. I mean, just constantly I'm hearing about somebody else who has it again, and I am dreading it because I'm certain we are not going to be exempt from that.
Yep.
I have already had it twice despite being vaccinated.
Same.
And yep. I mean, I know being vaccinated doesn't keep you from getting it, it just lessens the symptoms. And I'm honestly terrified to know what my experience would have been like without a vaccine.
Yeah, because you had a rough go.
Oh, it was yeah. really bad the first time around. And the second time was not appreciably better. And so I'm definitely not looking forward to that either. And I felt pretty badly for you this past week because I know it's just miserable.
It was. My husband obviously really stepped up. Like, basically, I slept most of the entire weekend. So he took the kids, did kids sports practices, you know. My parents ran over some food. I was chuckling to myself, you know, this weekend coming up is my birthday. And so for my 40th birthday last year, we were supposed to go out of town, but I had a work thing that blew up, so I had to cancel that at the last minute, and I ended up staying home with shingles on my 40th birthday, and I'm just waiting for like my kids or my husband to get COVID and us just be stuck at home with COVID for this one. So it's really celebrating in style when you're an adult with these things, as well, you know.
I was going to say, welcome to the tradition of amazing 40th birthdays.
Exactly. So yeah, that's what's going on in our lives right now. Basically just me trying to, my kids are dying because I won't let them hug me. And so they like give air hugs from across the room.
Yeah.
So that's been the hardest part because they're always like, Mom, air hug, which is really sweet that they care that much and want to do it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully nobody else gets sick.
Exactly. Knock on fake wood paneling in my car and hope for the best.
Well, I have our hot topic today. This has been blowing up on Twitter, and then I think it started blowing up in mainstream media. I didn't know who this individual was. Now former professor Joshua Wright was an antitrust professor at George Mason University's School of Law, which either is or was the Antonin Scalia School of Shithead Law. So... there you go.
I don't, people kept, it brings me joy that the initials are ass law. I don't know if they like were, is it like the school is named the Antonin Scalia School of Law at
Probably.
George Mason University? Is that what it, I don't even know. That when I learned that, it just left my brain immediately. So I didn't
retain I mean,
that bit of knowledge.
I think that alone tells you that it's like a festering hot pot of Federalist Society wackadoodles. Anyway, he was until recently a professor there, and this all came to my attention on Twitter earlier this month because he tweeted about how he was resigning from the law school to start his own law firm, and a bunch of bros were coming out of the woodwork to congratulate him.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly wouldn't have seen it. I do not overlap with his Twitter circle.
Yeah.
But another Professor Krista Laser at Cleveland State University responded directly to his tweet. And she said, I will note that Josh Wright was hiring chair at George Mason Law when I applied many years in a row, desperate to stay in the same city as my children. I received a meeting after I announced I was single. He asked me out after our meeting. He remained head of antitrust. And she screenshotted the email that he sent her, where he says, Hi, Krista. I hope this doesn't come off as overly forward, but I really enjoyed dinner and talking with you and thought maybe you might be interested in making next time a date? And she wasn't hired. She didn't go on the date and she was not hired. And she said she told HR at George Mason and she followed up about a year after telling them and they were like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so she brings this to light and she's basically like, hey, I just want people to know, like, if somebody asks you for a job, don't also ask them on a date.
Pretty basic.
Yeah. Job Pretty applicants basic. Are not your dating pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that. And honestly, I didn't make much of it because to me, it's like, oh, it's another scumbag abusing his position of authority and influence. I am unfortunately unsurprised by that. And then a few days later, Law360 published an article about Josh Wright. And the headline was, quote, "I suffered silently," end quote. Ex-law prof allegedly preyed on students. And it names two women, now a Kirkland and Ellis partner and counsel at Freshfields, which is a law firm and not a grocery store, mm-hmm. who were law students together at George Mason University. And as first-year law students, Wright approached them to ask them to be research assistants and started sexual relationships with both of them while they were his law students and working for him.
Gross.
One of the women, the woman who's a partner at Kirkland and Ellis, Elise Dorsey, and I'm using her name because she spoke with Law 360. She spoke with Law 360, and there are other developments we'll get to. But according to Elise, Wright asked her to be one of his research assistants at the end of her 1L year and suggested that if she did well as his research assistant, he could help her get a job after law school. And she told Law 360 that despite a string of flirtatious comments, she generally thought Wright was harmless at the time and felt reassured by the fact that he was married and had small children. But then he asks her to go with him on a trip to meet clients in California, because I guess while he was this professor, he also had his own law firm doing like legal advising on antitrust issues and consulting. Well, when she gets to the hotel in California, she finds out that Wright has booked them a single room with a single bed.
So gross.
This was ostensibly a client meeting, but she says there were no client meetings during the trip. Instead, they went wine tasting. And she told Law 360 that the morning they were supposed to leave, Wright asked if he could touch her, and she did not feel like she could say no in that moment. And according to her, he pressured her to have sex in his office on the campus. And after she graduated law school, he was nominated to be FTC commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And she says their sexual contact stopped. But then when he left the FTC in 2015, he joined the firm she was at, which I think was Wilson Sonsini.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And once again, he became her direct manager and sexual contact resumed. And it's kind of unclear what happened, but according to Law 360, Elise then left Wilson Sonsini. She started working at Wright's law firm, quits when she found out he was engaged in a sexual relationship with another former George Mason student of his. And she said that there were consequences for her for ending that sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. She'd been working on a fellowship opportunity, doing work at George Mason. The fellowship opportunity disappeared and her work at George Mason stopped abruptly. And so in late 2021, she filed a complaint against Wright with George Mason, alleging violations of Title IX and university policies about consensual sexual relationships. Law 360 also detailed allegations from Angela Landry, who's at Freshfields. She also started law school in 2009. Wright also approached her about being his research assistant, suggesting that, again, if she did well, he could help her get a job after law school. But she says he started making boundary pushing comments like how it seemed, quote unquote, cute, that she seemed nervous. And then in February of her 1L year, he kissed her. And I saw somebody describe this guy as looking like a thumb with a face drawn on it, which I think is accurate.
It really is.
Another one of our friends described him as looking like a bloated soup dumpling. Also accurate.
So accurate.
And I say this not to suggest that all sexual harassers are uggos, but it does kind of track like this guy's allegedly sexually harassing people who couldn't say no to him because he doesn't seem like
he has a position of power over them.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Angela also says to Law 360, she felt like she couldn't say no to him, that he often reminded her of his connections and the sway he held when it came to her career. And they also engaged in sexual activity at the law school. She says if she ever did anything in their personal relationship that made him mad, then that impacted the work she was getting from him as a research assistant. And their sexual contact stopped at some point. But then when he was at the FTC, Wright asked her to work as an attorney advisor for him. And she says that when she started, she told him, look, I just want to keep things professional. I want to start over with a clean slate. And she thinks he took that as a joke or a challenge. And sexual contact resumed, and she felt like if she made him mad, she would lose her job and her career. And details are fuzzy here, but she told Law360 he emailed her at some point apologizing for his behavior. And when they later met in person, he told her that he'd sought sexual relationships with countless women in professional settings.
Naturally, as one does.
Of course. And then Professor Crystal Laser, who was the one whose tweet I initially saw, also gave Law360 more details and said that when she was on the job hunt, Wright was the chair of George Mason's law school's antitrust department. And she had reached out to him before to be like, hey, can we have coffee to discuss your hiring? He switched it up on her, asked her to dinner. She went. After dinner, he walked her to her car, gave her a hug that she described to Law360 as, quote, pressing too close to my body for a work meeting.
Gross.
You and I have discussed our policy before on hugging in the workplace, which is, please don't do that to me.
Don't. There's no reason to hug in the workplace.
I don't need it. Please don't do it.
Yes.
And the next day, he sent her that email saying, hey, can we go on a date? Then, and again, I honestly didn't even see this article when it came out. Like, I've been busy with other stuff. I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
What I did see...
I was about to say, but what made you find it, huh?
Yeah. What I did see was a whole lot of discussion on Twitter when Wright sued Elise and Angela in Virginia State Court on August 24th. One of our mutual friends, who I will do the favor of not crediting here, described Wright's lawsuit as, Your Honor, the crux of this argument is this. These hoes ain't loyal. And Wright opens with this. Defendants Elise Dorsey and Angela Landry, both scorned former lovers and law students of plaintiff Joshua Wright, have embarked on a vendetta to destroy his reputation, portray themselves as Me Too victims, and make a fortune in the process. What are your thoughts about this, Start?
You know how they say you need to own up to bad facts before the other side points them out? He was like, I'm going to own up to the fact that I was sleeping with my law students in the first line of my defamation complaint.
I want everybody to know.
Just what a piece of shit I am. Yes.
Yeah, I was engaged in sexual relationships with people whose grades and jobs I was responsible for. And basically, he's like, look, Elise, she's jealous. I ended my relationship with her to start dating my current girlfriend, and we will come back to the current girlfriend.
Yes.
And Elise just fucking lost her shit. She couldn't handle it. And he says Elise, quote, embarked on a premeditated plan to ruin Mr. Wright's life. And he claims the Title IX complaint that she filed with George Mason was false. And then says... Next, Elise attempted to recruit other former girlfriends of Mr. Wright to join her crusade, which is like, how many are there?
Yeah. this legion of women of former law students and girlfriends that she approached.
Why? Like, sir, I have a question about why there are so many former law students of yours that you apparently had sexual relationships with while they were at the law school that she is able to attempt to recruit multiple of them.
Yes, seriously.
And Wright's story about Angela is the same. When our relationship ended, she lost our shit. And he says at least one of his major clients terminated its relationship with him when allegations started coming to light. Kirkland and Ellis also terminated a consulting relationship with him. He claims Angela and Elise made a multi-million dollar demand from him to settle any claims that they might have. And
wait, hang on. I want to point out something about that, because he says, listen, they embarked on this, you know, shame campaign against me, and then they made this $1 million demand, you know, multi-million dollar demand to keep quiet, or, you know, or else. And I was like, but you said they already went on the campaign against you. It's already public. Like, what's the extortion if they've already done it? Like, it doesn't even make sense when you tell the story.
Right. Like, they're already telling people. They're not being quiet about it. They've talked to Law360. Like, and he does say that the Law360 article came after he was like, no, I'm not going to pay you any money. But they're clearly out there telling this to people.
Yes.
And he says the Law360 article has a bunch of lies and omissions, quote, intended to create the false implication that Wright abused his position as a law professor to pressure Elise and Angela into having unwelcome sexual relationships with him. And that trip to the wine country that we took, he says, that's false. That is false. In fact, quote, This account is a lie. While the trip itself did happen, defendant Elise Dorsey and Mr. Wright were already in a romantic sexual relationship, which changes the entire context of the event.
She was the law student I was already fucking, not the one I was going to fuck.
Yes! The trip was not some ruse to get defendant Dorsey into a hotel room alone. It was a romantic getaway for two lovers to spend time in wine country. And I read this and I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, my dude.
Like, it's like the cringe is off the charts, first of all, with this. And second of all, one thing that, you know, really tripped my radar was he talks about how inaccurate the Law 360 article was, but gosh, he didn't sue them. That was weird because they might have resources to fight back and wouldn't be just scared away by a defamation lawsuit.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, this isn't a story about me being a sexual predator. It's a story about me being in a love triangle with my students.
Yes, these jealous, jealous students.
Yes. And then he also has beef with the fact that Law 360 reported that George Mason University has a consensual relationships policy. And apparently, until all of this blew up, the policy was like, hey, we recommend you don't have relationships with people you supervise or whose grades you might have control over, which that's plainly inadequate.
Yeah, do better.
That's a shitty ass policy.
Yes.
Anyway, he's like, excuse me, quote, notably, the consensual relationships policy is a disclosure policy that went into effect on June 28th, 2012. Elise and Angela graduated in May 2012, and therefore that policy was not in effect at the time. And it's like, you know, admitting that you abused your position of trust and authority while the law school didn't have a formal policy that you violated is not really the gotcha that you think it is.
No. It reminded me so much of Ross and Friends when he was dating the grad student as a professor. And he was like, it's not illegal. It's frowned upon. And kept telling everybody that it was frowned upon. That's him. He's like, oh, no, there was no policy. It was just frowned upon to have a love triangle with the law students you're teaching.
Yeah, except he's not even like it. He's not even acknowledging the frowned upon part. He's just like, listen, I like to bang my law students. What's the problem with that?
Laissez-faire, free market. They should know better.
Wright has now sued Angela and Elise for defamation, tortious interference, conspiracy.
Yes.
And he wants $108 million from them.
Which is so laughable. And also such evidence that all this is like a thuggish attempt to shut them up and punish them for speaking out.
No, well, I mean, not just punish them, but it is an attempt to silence anybody else who might want to come forward. Yes. That's really what it is. Because to your point, he didn't sue Law 360. He also did not sue Professor Laser.
Nope.
It looks like it's completely calculated to make sure that nobody else comes forward.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say, by the way, the main attorney who filed this on behalf of Josh Wright also looks like a fucking thumb.
He does. He looks like a thumb.
And interestingly, there is a woman on the team as well, which, wow, it must feel great to be a tool to prop up sexual harassers. So congratulations on that career path.
Oh, well, I mean, that firm has represented Trump before, so we know where they stand. Yeah.
So all of this happens, and the general consensus on Twitter was like, look at this absolute fucking asshole committing a complete self-own.
It was a pure, pure Streisand effect with this lawsuit. Because it probably flew under the radar for most people when Law 360 even did the article about him. But boy, that complaint blew up on Twitter and all over the internet.
It sure did. And most everybody I saw was like, well, way to file an I'm a sex pest lawsuit.
Yes, yes. Like the very first line in your lawsuit, you're like, yes, I'm a sex pest.
I'm announcing it to the world. But then yesterday, Bloomberg published an article.
Yes.
It's called Ex-FTC Commissioner Faces Storm of Sexual Harassment Allegations. And they have eight women 8, who told them about how Wright used his positions and influence to proposition female students, staff, and job applicants. There's one 2009 graduate who said Wright began a 2-year sexual relationship with her in 2006. So that probably would have been when she was a 1L or a 2L.
Mm-hmm.
She was his law student, also his research assistant. She said he frequently sought sex in his law school office. And gross. Again, reserved only one room with a single bed when they went to a 2007 conference in Boston while she was a law student.
He's got to move. He's going to stick with his move.
A 2016 grad said Wright sent her inappropriate and suggestive texts and once, air quotes, joked about mm-hmm. staying at her apartment while on a business trip as FTC commissioner.
He's the FTC commissioner at this point, telling a law yes. student these jokes. And we're supposed to believe that, oh, they're just knowingly doing all of this. When here's not only their professor, a commissioner of the FTC. And we're supposed to believe that they could be like, no, I'm not interested. Thank you. Please don't retaliate against me.
Well, but it's also like, what's the joke? Like, what's yeah. funny about that? You're the yes. FTC commissioner. Surely you can afford a hotel. The government will pay for your hotel. Yes. There is no reason for you to have to stay in anybody's apartment. Like, it's what's the joke? You're just, I mean, really, it's so obviously what he's hoping is that she'll be like, yeah, sure, come stay at my yeah. apartment and we can have sex. Yeah.
It's a joke if you think I'm kidding, and it's not if you're not.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Another George Mason student and former FTC intern for Wright said he invited her to a conference in California in 2014 and booked only one room with one bed.
Gross.
Another student and former FTC intern said he frequently joked about buying a condo with a hot tub that would have a, quote, no clothes rule. When she graduated, he bought her a bottle of bourbon that he delivered to her apartment himself and insisted they drink together.
Just professor things.
That has really gross vibes.
Yeah. Yes.
Another George Mason student and research assistant said he frequently made sexually suggestive jokes and on a business trip repeatedly pressured her to drink bourbon in his hotel room with him. The most damning thing I learned from this article.
Yes, I know where you're going with this. And yes, I agree. It is the most damning.
The current girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
The one who apparently Elise was supposedly so mad and jealous over mm-hmm. is a former student of his who interned for him at the FTC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of unclear what the timing is because he is very vague about dates in his lawsuit, which should be another giant question mark for people. Like, yes. why are we being so iffy about when things happen? But he does say in his lawsuit that his romantic relationship with Elise overlapped with this current girlfriend at some point. Mm-hmm. And eventually he like breaks off with Elise to be with the current girlfriend. So we have yet another former student who interned for him at the FTC.
It's so gross. And there was one other thing about this lawsuit, his complaint that he filed, and I'm not going to get into the details of what he said, but he went out of his way to put embarrassing professionally or personal yes. things in the complaint to shame the women that he's suing. Like, literally, there was no point for most of the things that he was putting in there about them, but he did it just so that it would be public record. And it was so evident that that was his entire point.
And again, to make an example out mm-hmm. of them for anybody mm-hmm. else who wants to complain. You want to complain? Then who knows what yeah, exactly. I am going to tell the world about you? Mm-hmm. And for some of these people, like Elise is a partner, the other woman is... Yeah, I think of counsel, but, you know, in any event, she graduated in 2012, so she's been practicing for more than 10 years at this point. There may be other women who are much more recent graduates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A 2016 grad that was in that article. I mean, that's sure. a much more recent graduate. There could be even earlier than, you know, later than that.
Yes, there could be much more recent graduates who are looking at this thinking, I better just keep my head down and not say anything because who knows what's going to happen to me or what he's going to say or do mm-hmm. if I do come mm-hmm. forward. Then Wright's story to Bloomberg was, look, I didn't sexually harass or coerce anyone. This was all completely consensual. Like, look, I just happen to like dating exclusively from a pool of people who might be penalized if they don't acquiesce to my sexual advances.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's just a preference.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just exactly. my thing. Then what kicked all of this off was his tweet saying, like, yes. I'm going to commit to doing my own law firm thing. I'm not going to be a professor at George Mason anymore. Law firm's the way to go. According to Bloomberg, he did that because George Mason was going to fire him as a result of its investigation into all of these allegations against him. George Mason says they conducted an exhaustive investigation into him, and he resigned in lieu of being terminated.
Which is, being a tenured professor and getting fired from university is about as rare as it's as rare as it gets, basically.
That takes some work.
Yeah,
that takes some effort and some work.
You really, really have to try to get fired as a tenured professor.
Yeah. The FTC also told Bloomberg that it is aware of allegations that Wright had inappropriate relationships with subordinates there, and the current chair has encouraged anyone with information to come forward. Wilson Sonsini confirmed that it had investigated sexual misconduct claims against him. And you have to wonder, I mean, he was only there from 2016 to 2019, so you got to wonder why that short tenure.
Mm-hmm.
Google terminated its relationship with him after the allegations became public, and we mentioned Kirkland and Ellis terminated a relationship with him as well. So worst of luck to this alleged sex pest.
Exactly. Worst of luck to him. Hope your lawsuit goes down in a just flaming pile of garbage.
I mean, the thing is, he's essentially guaranteed that this is not going away.
Yes, he chose Virginia because Virginia has an extremely weak anti-slap statute. So he knows that the women don't have the procedural mechanism to defend themselves that many other states would afford them.
Yeah. This, to me, just exemplifies how crazy it is when people suggest that women have ulterior motives in making allegations like this public. Like, there are tremendous consequences for coming forward with allegations like these. And here we are, where he is attempting to silence them and other women who might be thinking about coming forward with this bullying, harassing lawsuit.
That was the first thing I thought when I saw his complaint was, why don't women report it if it happens to them? This is why women don't report it. And it could be, you know, it doesn't have to be a complaint. It could be whispers. It could be just unofficially being blackballed somewhere because, you know, the men talked. And you will more than likely have professional consequences for coming forward in the year 2023. And it's just something you have to weigh.
Yeah. So that's our fun hot topic.
Well, from one sex pest to from one sex pest to another, let's give an update on Ken Paxton.
All right.
So we are looming. The trial date for Ken Paxton is next Tuesday. It is absolutely looming. And so since then, the House investigators have been posting all of their evidence that they collected during their investigations of him this spring that determined why they would impeach him or whether they would impeach him. Ken Paxton's lawyers had filed basically a motion to dismiss in the Senate saying, well, they don't have any evidence of all these things that they claimed. And so the House investigators are basically like, motherfucker, you want evidence? Here's evidence. And so they uploaded everything. And not only did they upload everything, but, you know, journalists have been getting that and then going crazy on their own investigations as well.
Amazing.
And so the news has just been unstoppable recently and diving into more details about Ken Paxton's misdeeds and shenanigans in the Attorney General's office. And more than anything, the Texas Tribune continues to be absolutely on it in their Paxton coverage. Today, we learned more all about those subpoenas that the quote-unquote special prosecutor, Brandon Kamik, sent to competitors and creditors of Nate Paul in the name of the Attorney General's office. In the past, that last Paxton episode, we discussed how it was so coincidental that Kamik sent those subpoenas to all the people Nate Paul believed were conspiring against him. And today, the Tribune had a story with evidence that Paul not only told Kamik where to send those subpoenas, but also wrote the actual subpoenas himself and then sent the language to Brandon Kamik to serve.
That is insane.
It's not common. It's not common. It's not a common thing. And Kamik, Nate Paul's lawyer, and Nate Paul referred to this as Operation Deep Sea. And so they have emails going back and forth about Operation Deep Sea. And
can we just pause and pull back and talk about how crazy it is that a private citizen is able to so directly pull the levers of state law enforcement to investigate and harass a litigation opponent. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was the House investigators basically said that Nate Paul used the office of the attorney general as his, quote, concierge law firm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a brilliant description because it seems to be exactly what was going on. Because as a reminder, these subpoenas were sent to the federal prosecutors investigating Nate Paul, federal court clerks, police officers, the head of the charity that was in litigation with Nate Paul, the charity's lawyer representing the charity in the litigation, and the court-appointed lawyer's or the charity's lawyer's wife received a subpoena as well. And there's just no credible reason that a lawyer's wife of a litigation opponent should be receiving a subpoena from the office of the attorney general at this point.
That's wild.
When Kamik was hired by Paxton, remember that was all on the DL. None of Paxton's deputies knew that. Kamik immediately had a 3-hour meeting with Nate Paul and his lawyer. And then days later, Kamik received from Paul's lawyer a document titled Operation Deep Sea. And that contained a matrix, basically a chart of the suggested targets for the subpoenas, with the language that should be included in the subpoenas.
Wow.
And Brandon Kamik, as we've discussed, demonstrated that attention to detail that got him the job. He forgot to switch from Paul's first-person perspective, and so referred in the subpoenas to Paul's creditors as, quote, my lender in the subpoenas language.
Oops, that'll raise some eyebrows.
Nate Paul's lawyer also instructed Kamik to call the subpoena targets, and if they don't talk, then we'll show up at their residence tomorrow. And that would be Nate Paul's lawyer and Brandon Kamik, the quote-unquote special prosecutor for the Office of the Attorney General, showing up to interrogate these subpoena targets.
Which included, as you said, a federal judge and federal law enforcement?
Yes. And there's two sets. Remember, there were two conspiracies that Nate Paul believed in. So that was the law enforcement conspiracy. He also believed that Austin businessmen and banks were conspiring to bankrupt him to take all his property.
Yeah, it can't possibly be that he's a shitty businessman.
Never. No, it's the people. They're out to get me.
Yeah.
We learned that Kamik likes to record things. So when he showed up with Nate Paul's lawyer that day to personally serve the subpoenas on the bank presidents that we talked about, he was filming it, apparently, and so the House investigators received that film and that recording and watched the whole thing. And the bank presidents were actually what unraveled this entire plan. Oh. They were personally served, and the bank's lawyers get this subpoena and look at it and were like, what the fuck? So they email Kamik in the attorney general's office directly, basically wanting proof that he was a quote-unquote special prosecutor for the attorney general's office. And that email, and, you know, the attorney general deputies were like, who the hell is this guy? And is what set this whole thing off.
Wow. Okay.
So the deputy attorney general that finds this out contacts Kamik and tells him to stop work immediately. And again, showing that great judgment that got him hired in the first place, Kamik immediately forwards an email to Paxton titled Urgent in all caps. And it's like, they told me to stop working. What do? We need to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's keeping notes on his criminal conspiracy.
I was going to say, put it in writing, girlfriend.
Exactly. We finally learn that after all this went down, Nate Paul's lawyer made a third complaint to the attorney general's office and demanded an investigation. So this is after everything blows up, after Kamik is removed as a special prosecutor, Nate Paul's lawyer makes this third complaint demanding an investigation. And this time, the complaint was that the deputy attorney generals had inappropriately intervened to stop Kamik's investigation and lied when they said that his investigation lacked merit. So, you know, once more into the breach, trying to get this done. And Paul's lawyer was like, the actions of the employees of the OAG have severely harmed and disadvantaged a Texas citizen. And so he claimed this. And that was not acted upon because at that point, you know, Paxton was wise to what was going on. We have also learned they've posted the witness lists for the trial. So that's going to be extremely interesting. Paxton's mistress is listed as a witness. his body man and personal courier is listed as a witness as well. He'll testify about how he is the one that basically discovered Paxton was having his renewed affair with his mistress when he found them at the Omni at Barton Creek in 2020 together, when that guy was just there on a family trip. So it's going to be very interesting. There was scuttlebutt that, you know, Dan Patrick was going to force Paxton to resign to basically avoid this entire mess, but Paxton has been very loudly saying that he'll never resign, and he was fundraising, I think, today with his donors, saying that he'll never surrender and never resign, and raising money for his defense.
He's got to hoover up as much money as he can from fundraising while he can, because
exactly,
if he does actually resign, how is this guy going to get money? Because this is something you and I talked about before, which is we have somebody who's making like $150,000 or $175,000 as the state AG, right? Mm-hmm. It's a really low amount.
Yes. His wife makes, what, $17,000 a
year? No, $7,000.
$7,000. That's right. Yes. Sorry. I overinflated that.
Yeah. Yeah. You gave her a $10,000 raise. She makes $7,000 as a state senator. She was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Before this, we have been told that they don't come from money. And so you're mm-hmm. like, where are these people getting money to buy multiple multi-million dollar properties? So he's got to fundraise because once he is unable to fundraise, the money spigot is off.
Yes. I think it's what, 6 properties that we know of and maybe up to 10 that they own, you know, just normal people things with your 10,
sure,
your 10 real properties that you own.
Real folksy stuff.
Mm-hmm. So that starts on Tuesday, the trial, and I cannot wait. I'm very excited to watch it. It's going to be extremely messy. And we mm-hmm. already have our group text set up so that we can
yes.
live text with various people. About the goings on. So I am very excited to watch this. It's terrible for our state, terrible for democracy, terrible for the people of Texas, but great content. So, I mean, you got to love that for us.
I don't know. I might disagree with you. I think it's excellent for everybody to see out in the open what a fucking goat show clown rodeo these people are running. Even if
fair.
the trial is, I mean, trial, we should be using air quotes because
yeah, exactly. That's, mm-hmm.
this is not a judicial proceeding. The judge, our Lieutenant Dan Patrick, is somebody to whom Ken Paxton owes money.
Yes.
Right?
A former right-wing radio host, Dan Patrick.
Yeah, like, by that, the way.
Yes, yes.
He's a former radio guy, obviously qualified to preside over some sort of trial. Like,
yes.
It's just it's a political show. It's not actually, you know, something that we yes. should take very seriously. But I don't mind a little sunshine on a little sunshine disinfectant.
But I just don't think the disinfectant will happen is where I get the pessimism from. We'll see the sunshine and then we'll just
yeah.
slap on some sunscreen and nothing will change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure lined up behind yeah. Ken Paxton is somebody equally as terrible or significantly worse, but
yeah, he's actually effective. Yes.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. I'll take what I can get for the moment.
Fair. I think that's very fair. Little victories, right?
Yeah, we got to take it where we can get it. Like, listen, I'm waiting for the power to go out at any moment, so I'll take it.
Every day, every minute that we have power, it's a great accomplishment tonight.
Yep. What a blessing.
Well, that was our two hot toppies, and now on to our main story, which I have teased this now, and it's not exactly a lawyer behaving badly, but it is an indulgence to talk about a case that's fascinating on several levels and mm-hmm. local. How familiar are you with the Ticket radio station in Dallas?
I'm not. I know it does sports stuff, and my husband mm-hmm. listens to it occasionally.
Yeah, that's what knowing you well, I didn't think that you were like a big listener of it. I'm going to be very honest.
I won't be offended by that assessment.
Yeah. I am a big fan, P1, as we call ourselves, because they are preset one on the radio.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. You have to be in the club to know that, KP. So I'm sorry. Let me talk to your husband. We'll discuss these things.
I know. Should we swap out hosts? We'll get my husband yeah. in here for the rest of this.
I have listened almost every day since we moved back here in 2008, either in the car on the way to work or getting ready in the mornings. It's where we get news, and my husband listens too, so we listen in our bathroom while we get ready. The kids know it, although the kids refer to it as our radio podcast because they don't know what like radio is. They just know right. podcasts.
Right.
So they're like, is just a podcast with commercials all the time?
What is so this?
The kids know it. Huge fan. A little bit of history about the Ticket. It was founded in 1994 by one of the old hosts. His name was Mike Reiner, and it was the first all sports station in Dallas. The original lineup was Mike Reiner, 2 hosts who are still there in the morning, and then 3 hosts who have since left. One of those hosts that has left was Skip Bayless, which I think you have heard of before.
I've heard that name.
Yeah, he's a blowhard. And the other is Kurt Menefee, who is a current sportscaster. I think he now does the CBS football show, but, you know, a legit sportscaster. Since the time it started, the station has had several owners. For a while, it was owned by a company called Susquehanna Pulsegraph and was purchased by Cumulus Media in 2006. In 2009, CBS Radio tried to poach Mike Reiner, the founder, who was then co-hosting the afternoon drive show, and he almost accepted but received an increased compensation package from Cumulus and stayed. And I bring that up because all these quote-unquote almost moves are basically how these radio hosts negotiate raises as we go along. So it takes a threat and a job offer, essentially, to get a raise from all these hosts. So it's a very common thing to hear, oh, well, they're going to go join so-and-so. And then a few days later, they announce, no, they're staying, and you find out they got a raise. Yeah. It's basically how you have to get paid. In January 2020, Mike Reiner retired from the Ticket, and this was a huge deal because he'd been broadcasting since the day he created the station in 1994. And in a side note, in 2022, he created a competing radio station called The Freak in Dallas, and a ton of former Ticket talent immediately ran over there and started their own shows as well. So they've been directly competing with the Ticket since early 2022, I think is when he started that.
I am so out of radio because I gotta be honest with you. I can't even remember the last time I've listened to radio because I'm either listening to audiobooks or I'm listening to podcasts or I'm listening to music on Spotify. And so it's been so long since I've listened to radio. I had no idea we had a radio station called The Freak here in Dallas.
It's relatively new, so I'll excuse you that. But yeah, I think it's small because last I checked, the Ticket, like every quarter or month or whenever they do sweeps and listening, the Ticket wins by a mile in every category. Mm-hmm. It's by far the most listened to station in the Dallas market. And one reason is because so many of the hosts have been there at the station for years. You know, the morning show hosts have been there since day one. And many of the hosts start there as interns, then they become producers, they become yuck monkeys, and then they work their way to main hosts of the shows. And that's basically what happened to one of the hosts we'll talk about a lot today, Jake Kemp. Jake worked at the Ticket on and off in high school, then became a board operator, then hosts the nightly recap show that's called The Ticket Top 10, and then began producing shows. He was also the host of the Mavs after game shows. And since 2010, he's hosted his own podcast called It's Just Banter with another Ticket personality. Keep that in mind, too. Okay. For years at the Ticket, the midday show was called Bad Radio, which stood for the hosts Bob and Dan. And so we'll be talking a lot about Dan McDowell as well today. Native of Cleveland, he's been at the Ticket since 1999. Side note, Dan lives in Southlake. And every now and then they would talk about like the insanity of Carroll ISD. And it was like, oh, there is another one of us out there that like sees this insanity. So I always felt a little kindred spirit with Dan. For a while, Jake was the producer of Bad Radio and worked with Bob and Dan and basically worked as like a third on their show. A few years ago, before 2020, it was also a badly kept secret that Bad Radio was in tense contract negotiations with Cumulus and threatening to leave for another station. And they ultimately worked it out at the 12th hour and stayed on the Ticket with a raise. Again, here we go. When Mike Reiner retired in 2020, it caused this big shakeup in the daily lineup of the shows because one of their main hosts in the afternoon drive was retiring. Bob from Bad Radio goes to the afternoon drive show, and Jake is promoted to full-time tier one host with Dan. And they begin their show called The Hang Zone together in February 2020.
Okay.
So see, now you're getting now it's clicking for you.
Well, because my husband listens to that. Okay. Or listened rather.
Yes. Got it. Yeah. And I know we've talked about your husband listened to it. The Hang Zone, of all the major shows on the Ticket, The Hang Zone was my favorite. And so that's also personally why this was so fascinating to me as well. Jake and Dan were my favorite hosts. Somewhat surprisingly, in July 2023, we find out that Dan and Jake announced that they would no longer be employed by the Ticket after they failed to reach an agreement on new employment contracts with Cumulus. This first shows up in an industry story that I saw on Twitter, and then Jake and Dan post a YouTube video where they confirmed it was true. And they don't say anything damning in it. They basically just say it was a business negotiation. We had differences. We couldn't come to an agreement. We wish everybody well. You know, we're going to do our different thing. Keep listening to the ticket. Like, we have no ill will. Please don't stop listening to the ticket. We just, you know, it was a business decision. We couldn't agree. One major area that there was disagreement in those negotiations between Jake and Dan and Cumulus was that they wanted to make sure other crew members for the Hang Zone were paid more, because it's not just them that are the hosts. There's the board operator, the producers, you know, the sound guys, those kind of things. Those guys are paid a shockingly small amount. Like, literally, they were paid $27,000 a year for these jobs, which is insanely small when you think about how much
it's crazy.
Yeah, how many people are listening to these radio shows. Cumulus had offered these employees raises in the negotiations with Jake and Dan, but when Jake and Dan don't ultimately accept the deal, Cumulus yanked the raises away. And when they had offered the raises to these employees, they conditioned it on the premise that the employees would sign a non-compete with Cumulus.
That is what I had heard about.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so we'll talk more about non-competes in depth, but the idea that you have a non-compete because an employee who's making $27,000 a year is so critical to your business is a hard logical sell to me.
I was going to say, that one is tough to reconcile, that this person is so critical to your operations that you pay them less than $30,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're so critical. They can't work for a competitor, but not critical enough to be paid $30,000.
Like a living wage. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I watched the YouTube video where Dan and Jake teased, you know, we're leaving and then we may be looking at new media or different digital pursuits. Basically, we're tired of radio as it is. We want to go do something different anyway. And that's what they ultimately do. They start a Patreon podcast that is supposed to come out several times per week, and they call it The Dumb Zone. Slight confession for me, like I said, The Hang Zone was my favorite ticket show, so I immediately bought a Patreon subscription to The Dumb Zone.
So did my husband. Yeah, he was like, oh, snap.
Yeah, exactly. Like, take my money, say less, I'm in. And I wanted to see what it was all about, because honestly, like, the lawyer side of me was like, there has to be, like, Cumulus has to be pissed about this. And I can't wait to see what the fallout of this is from, like, a professional perspective. So I'm going to, I'm nosy. I want to watch. It was, the podcast was slightly similar to The Hang Zone in feel, obviously, because it's the same host. But the biggest difference I noticed between the radio show and the podcast is that, something you and I know, podcasts aren't live. Like, we are not live broadcasting to this. You record a podcast and then you have to edit. And as fast as you can possibly go, it takes at least a few hours to edit it and then post it for distribution. And so when you're talking about sports news or news, you have a very different feel, I think, from, you know, us talking about the news versus us talking about breaking news as we're talking and relaying information to people live, which we would be in a lot of trouble if we just had to give our live thoughts without editing.
Yeah, there's a reason we edit this podcast.
Exactly. There's one day we should, maybe our Patreon can be the cutting room floor and all the stuff we edit out.
Oh my God.
Anyway, The Dumb Zone produces a few episodes, and pretty quickly, Cumulus sends them each a cease and desist on July 25th. And we know this because Cumulus included it in their court filings, but we also know this because Jake and Dan talked about it in an episode of The Dumb Zone in a section titled, quote, listener feedback, which I thought was actually pretty funny. They read parts
of the, really funny.
They read parts of the cease and desist as their listener feedback. As is common for on-air talent, Jake and Dan, we've kind of talked about, had employment agreements, and those contained what we call restrictive covenants. The agreements were mostly the same, but there were some small differences. Dan's agreement had a non-compete that says he will not carry on a business that is the same or essentially the same as the company business. And his agreement also contains a non-disparagement clause about Cumulus and its business. Jake's agreement is slightly different than Dan's. He doesn't have a non-disparagement clause, but his agreement defines a competing business to specifically include podcasting. So any attempts at podcasting Cumulus would think are explicitly against his non-compete. Unsurprisingly, Dan and Jake do not cease and desist their podcast. They just keep it up. And so on August 4th, Cumulus sues Jake and Dan for breach of their non-competes and conversion and a couple other bullshit causes of action. KP, you've been following this lawsuit too, some, I know, because we've been texting each other about it a little bit. And we have a mutual friend that's very involved in it. Do you have any thoughts on filing their lawsuit in federal court versus state court?
It's a lot harder to win.
Yes. That's, I mean, yeah, that's simply put, yeah, that's exactly it. I was pretty shocked by them filing in federal court. And part of me wonders if they're represented by out-of-state lawyers generally or whatever it was. But the standards for getting a TRO in federal court are significantly higher than those in state court. And it's not as a matter of law, they're much higher. It's that federal court judges hear your arguments, and I literally have heard one say, I hear habeas petitions for death row prisoners. Why do you think you deserve a TRO for this business dispute? And you're kind of like, oh, yeah, exactly. You're kind of like, oh, okay. I guess let's go through what you need to show to get a temporary restraining order. You know, you're about to suffer or are suffering imminent, immediate, irreparable harm, and you need to maintain the status quo. The damage you're suffering can't just be money. You have to show that if money, you know, money can't just be the reimbursement for your damages. It has to be something that cannot be reimbursed by money. And you have to show a likelihood of success on the merits, which means that you have to bring as much evidence with you at as possible at your TRO. And basically, it's a little mini trial that happens right then with affidavits, possibly live testimony. And you have to show that granting the TRO would be in the best interest of public policy. So it's a high burden to get a temporary restraining order, and specifically one in federal court.
I don't understand what about this case couldn't be resolved through monetary damages. Like, what is the harm that cannot be compensated by monetary damages? I don't get it.
That's a great point.
Hold that thought. Put a pin in that one.
There is a certain cadence in the complaint when you're filing a lawsuit arguing breach of confidentiality, breach of non-compete, breach of non-solicit agreements. I sat and thought about it last night, and I've either drafted, defended, or managed, I think, probably around 100 of these lawsuits at this point.
Yeah, you had a lot of these at one point.
Yeah. Like in my private practice career, in my in-house career, we've had... This has come up a lot. So you kind of get into a routine and you begin the complaint by quickly outlining the parade of horribles that these ex-employees have done and will continue to do unless the court steps in to stop them. And then you demonstrate how they had agreements and these ex-employees knew that they had these and these nefarious employees breached them anyway. And then you demonstrate basically how those actions are causing you damage and money won't reimburse you. If you want injunctive relief, you're going to focus on the non-monetary damages. And one thing to keep in mind, just like I said, when we said put a pin in that, Jake and Dan's podcast is Patreon. They don't accept advertising. They only receive money through subscribers. I have something for you to read, and you tell me if this allegation just chills your blood.
Even more, immediately after Cumulus filed its verified original complaint on Friday, August 4th, 2023, defendants uploaded a video on Sunday, August 7th, 2023, stating publicly that they would not stop uploading the Dumb Zone. Defendant Kemp even mocked the complaint itself by listing his name as Kemp et al. In the video. Okay.
How dare you?
Damage. Your Honor, we have been gently mocked.
Exactly. Your Honor, they are trolling. Make them stop. Yeah. They are not allowed to do bits, Your Honor. There are several main allegations in the parade of horribles that Cumulus alleges Jake and Dan have done. The first was obviously starting the competing podcast, The Dumb Zone. Cumulus alleges that the existence of this podcast is competition, and it's particularly competition for Cumulus advertisers. You and I have looked at Patreon on and off when we think about potentially ever monetizing our podcast. Would you say that advertisers are a large part of the allure of Patreon for potential podcasters?
No, I think it's the opposite. Your donation keeps it so that you don't have to listen to stupid ads.
Exactly. Like, it's the entire point is you do that so you don't have to advertise.
Right.
Cumulus also argues that the competition is for any listeners of any audio program, basically. They argue that the non-compete includes radio, internet streaming, talk shows, podcasting, satellite radio, YouTube. Any type of streaming or audio program would be included in the non-compete. So they're really leaning into the unreasonable scope, I guess.
They're
here.
Like, no, they're like, anything that goes in your ear holes, we yes, get a piece exactly. of. It's stupid because maybe I'm an outlier, but like I said, I mean, like, I don't listen to radio. It's audiobooks and podcasts solely.
Yeah.
And I have to think that there are other people out there like me. I mean, just because something you can listen to it, I mean, it's not all interchangeable. It's not all the same.
Yeah. And I mean, you know me, I listen to audiobooks. I listen to Spotify. I also listen to the radio. I listen to lots of podcasts. And they each have a different place and time in my life. And it's not like yeah. a new podcast means that I listen to less radio because mm-hmm. I'm still listening to other radio. So I think it's just a basic misunderstanding of how people consume media these days, which I think Jake and Dan's lawyers take great pains to argue. Basically, this is an old radio company that hasn't gotten with the times and don't understand.
I was going to say, are you telling me that legacy media does not understand yes. the modern context of delivering content to consumers? I am just absolutely shocked.
Yeah. And that's Cumulus goes so far as to really make that point because they're like, not only that, we have podcasts of the Hang Zone too that they're directly competing with, but those podcasts are actually just pre-recorded radio segments that they then just like put on the internet. So basically mm-hmm. it's like, if you miss this segment of the radio on Tuesday, you can listen to it as a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not standalone podcasts.
Yeah.
And one different. Note, by the way, because I do listen, obviously, to The Ticket a lot, they have started running commercials for their podcasts in the past 2 weeks. And a little part of me is like, oh, what are you doing?
Uh-huh. I got it.
They then kind of walk back their argument about how broad their non-compete is. And as a professional podcaster, let me know if this section you read is a compelling argument on why the non-compete is not overbroad.
The agreements only, underlined, prohibit defendants from competing for those listeners who could consume content from The Ticket from within the DFW area. Indeed, defendants could easily take measures to geo-restrict access to the dumb zone from within the DFW area, but tellingly chose not to because the DFW area is precisely where the audience they are competing for is.
Why don't you just geofence your podcast?
And I don't know who to point the finger at for being stupid. Is it Cumulus or is it these lawyers? Is it mm-hmm. both? Because how do you geo-restrict access to your podcast?
It's like all IPs that come from
the DFW
Dallas.
Area. Yeah, it's yes. a complete lack of understanding of how this medium is even hosted and produced and distributed to listeners. That is so fucking stupid.
The second of the parade of horribles, and one that some people may not be aware of, is that when you work for a company and your job is to work on their social media accounts, generally those social media accounts belong to the company and they do not belong to you. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are obviously areas of gray, but generally those accounts belong to the company. And according to Cumulus, Dan and Jake took these social media accounts that the Hang Zone had and they were existing and basically rebranded them as the Dumb Zone. And my favorite allegation in their motion was that Dan and Jake rebranded the Hang Zone's Twitter account, thereby taking more than 22,000 followers of Cumulus's Twitter account. And I was like, my dude, I almost have 22,000 followers. Like, what are you complaining about?
That's not a number I'd put into yeah. a federal lawsuit because yeah. that's kind of embarrassing to be like a large company yes. complaining about that. Like, okay.
Like, we have friends that are lawyers with significantly larger followings than that.
Yeah, like, when you're getting dunked on by a couple of dork lawyers for how small your following yes. is, you really need to reevaluate your life choices.
They also allege that Dan and Jake, quote unquote, stole the logo for the Hang Zone that was owned by Cumulus and then just put their name over it. And it was a little house logo that said like the Hang Zone. And then the second logo said it was the same one, but they blacked out Hang on it and wrote dumb. And like, like when you take your iPhone and you do editing, they just wrote dumb over it in white. The one thing about the allegation, though, was that Cumulus didn't own the logo. It was just created by a listener for Jake and Dan.
Right, you don't own the IP.
Yes, and then a listener created the second one. Like, you don't get to assert ownership over things you don't own.
Yeah, I saw that and I was just like, what are we doing here?
Yes. It's like, have you even litigated these cases before?
Or how do you not understand that you don't own that IP? Like, there's such a disconnect between, say, like, Jake and Dan, who are running the show and who get fan artwork and turn it into their logo, and nobody in management has any understanding whatsoever that, hey, that was fan-created art. That's not something that we actually own.
Do you think they're going to show up with a license agreement for the fan-created art?
Right. Like, yeah. We don't actually have any rights to exploit that, much less turn around and sue these two guys for then creating, I mean, kind of like a parody, but I mean, using it essentially as the base for their new logo. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you not have any understanding of that before you just go and publicly embarrass yourself this way?
Well, they didn't. They just hauled off into court with it.
Much to my delight. So thank you for that.
Much to our delight. Cumulus alleges that Dan and Jake disparaged Cumulus. And remember, Jake's agreement had a non-disparagement clause, but Dan's did not. Cumulus doesn't give any, like, very concrete statements or examples of this disparagement, which we have said before is always a sign of a very weak argument to begin with.
That's also a problem when you're looking to get a TRO and then subsequently a temporary injunction when you have no disparaging statements to actually point to. You're just floating along on vibes.
Dan and Jake's response to included, you know, audio clips of them because Cumulus was like, they told people not to listen to the ticket and they made fun of the hosts. And so there's in their podcast, The Dumb Zone, and in their goodbye video, Dan and Jake take these pains to be like, keep listening to the ticket, quote, in fact, listen more. And then they talk about how they're very happy for the new host replacing them. And they talk about how these guys deserve a shot and deserve to be full-time hosts and everyone should listen to them. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty funny that Cumulus has these vague allegations and Dan and Jake are like, here's the audio at 3 minutes and 2 seconds where they say exactly the opposite. Cumulus did allude to Jake claiming that he worked as a host on a producer's pay and basically saying Cumulus was so cheap that, you know, I was a producer, I was promoted to a host, and then I worked on a producer's salary, and Cumulus was like, he's saying we're cheap. But we learn from Jake's declaration that when he was promoted to a tier one host of the Hang Zone, he was paid on a producer's salary for months after that until he received a raise. And then the raise was not retroactive. So he was working on a producer's salary as a radio host.
The complaint is that you are making public facts that make us look bad.
Yes. This is how you know that how so much of these lawsuits, just like you said, is tied up in ego and hurt feelings. Here's another portion of Cumulus's filing that is absolutely breathless about all the horrible deeds done by Jake to them.
Defendants portrayed Cumulus as quote-unquote cheap by falsely saying Kemp's pay never increased and mocked Cumulus's cease and desist letters.
They're being mean and trolling us, Your Honor.
I know.
Finally, Cumulus alleges that their damages are irreparable and money won't suffice. So just like we talked about, their evidence is, just like you said, lacking, to be honest. And their argument basically is, so long as the Dumb Zone exists, people may not listen to the ticket, which is, to me, seems like an admission that, hey, this was really popular talent and people are going to listen to them. So maybe you should have tried harder to keep them.
Mm-hmm.
They also allege that multiple sponsors have ended their relationship with the ticket over Dan and Jake leaving. But they don't have any evidence that ties to because Dan and Jake asked them to. You know, it could just as likely be they don't want to be associated with the station anymore if Jake and Dan aren't there.
That seems like a natural consequence of potentially any on-air talent changing.
Exactly. One of those sponsors was revealed in the witness lists for the potential hearing. But I will say I have been listening to the ticket more with the sponsors and listening, like, who don't I hear anymore? Mm-hmm. Like, who has pulled? Because I, again, I'm nosy. There's one complication in all of this litigation that we haven't discussed yet, and also why I think this litigation has the potential to be so fascinating, and that is the complication of the
NLRB, and I am so excited about this.
Yes, I am so excited about this. For those that don't know, the NLRB is the National Labor Relations Board. And one very common misconception is that the NLRB and the National Labor Relations Act only apply to workplaces with unionized employees.
That is wrong.
Wrong. The NLRA applies to all employers engaged in interstate commerce, which is basically all employers, as we know. And so generally, not to put you on the spot, but generally, how would you say the NLRB reviews non-competes?
Well, I would say generally it depends on which president is appointing members to the NLRB. Mm-hmm. But right now, they have an exceptionally dim view of non-competes and non-disparagement clauses.
Exactly. The National Labor Relations Act protects employees' rights to discuss the conditions of their workplace and to discuss it with other employees as well. Basically, that leads potentially to unionizing activity. It's a concerted activity. And the current NLRB believes very strongly that those rights need to be protected and not eroded. The GC of the NLRB issued an opinion that non-compete agreements and confidentiality agreements, disparagement agreements, violate the NLRA because they prevent employees from working together to carry out or threaten to carry out concerted threats to resign or improve working conditions, along with actually going to a competitor to improve your working conditions. Mm-hmm. And I mean, on the one hand, yeah, that's literally what they're there for. it is to keep employees there. Unbeknownst to Cumulus, Jake and Dan filed unfair labor practice charges with the NLRB, alleging that their non-competes and non-disparagement and confidentiality provisions of their agreements violate the National Labor Relations Act, which I thought was a fascinating twist and strategy decision on their part.
When I saw that in the responsive pleading that they filed, I died. Love it. Mm-hmm. A+. Cannot wait to see what happens.
Yeah. In Dan's declaration, we learn that in November 2021, Dan and three other ticket hosts met with Cumulus and told them, listen, all of our contracts expire at different times, and we want our contracts to expire at the same time so we can negotiate at once, and we have some power of negotiating as a group. And Cumulus management's response was only to tell them that they're not allowed to discuss their contracts with each other. And basically,
ooh,
absolutely not. Yeah, exactly.
Ooh, that to me sounds like you're telling your workers they cannot discuss their working conditions, which is a big, fat problem.
Yeah. And I think it shows us, too, how Cumulus treated their on-air personalities. If they knew, oh my gosh, if their contracts all expire at the same time, they might have some leverage on us. So let's make sure that doesn't happen. So it seems like, well, it was a very calculated choice, too.
It's not just the concern about the leverage. It's telling people that you can't discuss terms of your contracts. Like, why not? What do we have to worry about?
Exactly. Jake and Dan argue that the existence of this NLRB opinion preempts the federal court's jurisdiction, which I think is an aggressive argument. No court has ever held that before. It's a fascinating argument. We'll see, you know, if the court actually adopts that one. But as for whether the NLRB proper will take interest in the case as a test vehicle, that would be a fascinating development, I think, because they could look at this and say, here are two people who can, you know, afford, and two people who are popular enough that we may be able to create this test vehicle for what we believe to be, you know, illegal non-competition agreements. The one problem, obviously, is they're in the Northern District of Texas, which goes up to the Fifth Circuit.
That's what I was like, do you really want to do your test case in the Fifth Circuit? This is what we're doing? Okay.
And then you go to, you know, Supreme Court, which also...
Yeah, seems like you're really willing audience in all of these courts.
So we did this entire segment on it. There was supposed to be a hearing scheduled today for the temporary injunction. It was canceled last night because the parties said they were mediating, which is how these cases so often go. Mm-hmm. The aggrieved party is extremely upset and there's lots of ego involved. They want to double down and fight. And then basically as soon as the real work hits and the attorney's fees bills start hitting, everybody's like, you know, let's think about settling this. And so I do all of this 5 minutes before we started this podcast. I got an email notification that a new episode of The Dumb Zone had dropped. So I'm guessing right. a settlement
they're
happened.
Back.
Yeah, exactly. So they're back. So I hope you enjoyed all that. It was all for nothing. But they are, I can't wait to hear, yeah, we won't hear the specifics, but I literally was like, oh, I don't have time to listen to the podcast before this one starts, but I will be listening tomorrow morning. I can't wait to hear what they have to say about it.
I know you could have pulled a, I'm sick.
I know.
Listen to that instead of recording.
I was like, no, I wrote this damn script. We're going through it.
I know. We're doing it.
Yes.
We're doing it. Well, I'm glad because I had kind of paid attention to a little bit of it, but not fully. And I know my husband's been really interested in it. So I'm glad to dig a little bit more into it and happy that they're back recording.
Exactly. They're back recording and can't wait to listen. Go Jake and Dan. Good luck, guys.
I have next week's story. I think that I will be telling you a story about an attorney with some sticky fingers.
Ooh.
But we'll see, because as you and I were texting about before we started recording, yes. there is so much news happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
We will see.
Yeah, I don't know what my next one will be. It may be more Ken Paxton. We'll see what happens next week. Or I've got about three other topics that I want to dive into and see if one of them pans out. So we've got, we are rich in content, even after our 40th episode.
Who knew? Who would have guessed?
Exactly. Not us.
Yeah, not us. All right. Well, you can find us on social media at Bad Lawyer Pod. You can email us, badlawyerpod@gmail.com, and merch link is in the bio.
Thanks, guys.